I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk about the American response to the death of Stalin. And it was an event that was met in America with no small amount of anxiety, particularly around the President Eisenhower and, of course, the State Department and the CIA, all of whom were unsure as to the way in which Soviet policy would go next. Between the end of the Second World War in 1945 and 8 years later when Stalin died in 1953, the Americans had spent some considerable effort trying to understand Stalin and trying to understand his motivations, his outlooks, his plans for the future. And the predictability that eventually emerged in Stalin's worldview that the Americans could interpret was one of the few methods that either side had of navigating this moment of intense tension during the early stages of the Cold War, by which time after 1949 both sides were nuclear armed. The possibility of an unknown figure emerging to replace Stalin, possibly Beria, Khrushchev, Malenkov, or possibly even Molotov, meant that there was a great deal of uncertainty, and there was nobody, no intelligence asset inside the Soviet Union that could inform the CIA about what was likely to happen. In Tim Weiner's Legacy of Ashes, he writes, Alan Dulles had been Director of Central Intelligence for 1 week when, on March the 5th, 1953, Joseph Stalin died. We had no reliable inside intelligence on thinking inside the Kremlin, the agency lamented a few days later. Our estimates of Soviet long-range plans and intentions are speculations drawn from inadequate evidence. The new President of the United States was not pleased. Ever since 1946, Eisenhower fumed. All the so-called experts have been yapping about what would happen when Stalin dies and what we as a nation should do about it. Well, he's dead, and you can't turn the files of our government inside out in vain, looking for any plans laid. We have no plan. We are not even sure what difference his death makes. In a struggle between two nuclear-armed powers, where we're not existing anymore in a multipolar world, but really a bipolar one, understanding the intentions of the other is a key part of preventing nuclear war. And once the monolithic figure of Stalin was gone, a great deal of the predictability of his actions, however negative perhaps they might be, went with him. And instead, the President and the CIA had to rely on their imaginations to inform what might possibly happen next. Would the Soviets launch some preemptive strike on the USA? Would the Soviet bloc break up? Would there be a period of mass democratization in the Soviet Union? Weiner argues in his book that Stalin, in fact, had no plan, no overall design for global domination in the way in which the US projected this fantasy onto the Soviet Union. Rather, that he sought to avoid direct confrontation with America. He tried to see during the first Berlin crisis, the Berlin Airlift, how far America could be pushed. And he was simply looking to establish a sphere of influence around the Soviet Union, a protective cordon, whilst the Soviet Union rebuilt itself. And that the grand designs that were imagined that Stalin was involved in really were fantasies. There were obviously plenty of historians that would take issue with this view, particularly Robert Gallatly springs to mind. In his book Stalin's Curse, he presents Stalin as the consummate political and strategic mastermind who saw revolution and spread to China and saw was the kind of the figure behind the Korean War and also the dominator of Eastern Europe. Whatever the truth between these two views, it was obviously Khrushchev who inherited Stalin's position as General Secretary and by 1956 had denounced him in the secret speech. There's a stark disparity between living standards in the Soviet Union, devastated by Hitler's invasion, and the cost of reconstruction thereafter. By the time that Stalin had died, much of the country was still in a state of ruination, and agriculture was yet to fully recover, not just from Hitler, but from Stalin's collectivization as well. Soviet spending on arms in this period was considerable. A large proportion of GDP went on supporting the Red Army in its occupation of Eastern Europe. Ironically, the Red Army's role in Eastern Europe was in part to asset strip formerly wealthy countries such as Czechoslovakia and what became East Germany, in order to rebuild the Soviet economy. In America, living standards continued to improve and expand at a dramatic pace. The 1950s were an era of material abundance in America, of prosperity, of domesticity, of the development of suburban life, and really many of our notions of the American dream of mass consumption exist at this period of time, or can be kind of extrapolated from this period of time. However, the containment of the Soviet Union, which was one of Eisenhower's chief policy goals, we're not into the phase yet of the rolling back of communism that we see under John F. Kennedy, but the containment was based on vast military spending. Eisenhower believed that nuclear weapons were in many ways a cheaper alternative to navies, air forces, tanks and artillery and ground troops, and that these, along with covert forces, green berets as they emerged, and military advisors as they would eventually emerge in Vietnam, were going to be a lot more cost effective. What emerges under Eisenhower is a kind of politicized, militarized state, a state that exists upon a level of a high level, like the Soviet Union, of permanent defence spending, where there is a gigantic defence establishment and a defence industry, the two of which, meeting at the Pentagon, overlap with one another and have all sorts of nefarious and nepotistic connections with one another. Eisenhower, as a president, was far more invested in the CIA than Truman had been. Truman had, as we've talked about in previous podcasts, was quite sceptical of their use. He had been dissuaded from having any positive regard for them
by J. Edgar Hoover, and had, even though he had signed them really into existence in 1947 and 1949 respectively, Harry Truman still had misgivings about the CIA. Eisenhower saw them as part of his complement of tools to stand up to the Soviet Union, to stop the Soviet advance. And Eisenhower rather had fantasies of a covert war being waged around the world. When the National Security Council met once a week, and Alan Dulles, Eisenhower, Eisenhower's vice president, Richard Nixon, along with Dulles's brother, John Foster Dulles, Secretary of State, met and would discuss global hotspots, global points of, as they viewed it, subversion, communist subversion and trouble. And they saw themselves as a body really waging a global covert war. So this was the first time that the kind of the CIA values of people like Wild Bill Donovan and his contemporaries, it was the first time that their sorts of values really had permeated the Oval Office. And in Eisenhower, the CIA had a real enthusiast, someone that was very much convinced of their merits and convinced of the value of what the CIA could do. However, following the death of Stalin and realizing that there were limitations to Soviet penetration, to a CIA penetration of the Soviet Union, Eisenhower was highly anxious that, in his view, a surprise attack by the Soviet Union might be possible on America. On the 5th of June 1953, the NSC met, and Dulles told Eisenhower that the CIA could not give any prior warning through any of their intelligence channels about the possibility of a missile attack on America from the Soviet Union. This is a huge problem. The faith that Eisenhower placed in the CIA took a blow at this point, and the belief that the CIA was an infallible system of intelligence relay was fatally undermined. The CIA had to rely on guesswork and best fit predictions about the Soviet Union's nuclear capability. They assumed that it would be 1969 before the Soviets could launch an ICBM. However, the missile, the R-7 Semyorka, was launched first in 1957 and had 28 launches between 1957 and 1961, thus proving that the CIA were 12 years out with their prediction. It was 1953 when the Soviets launched their first thermonuclear bomb, or detonated the first thermonuclear bomb, shall I say. Again, the CIA weren't able to predict this. And this isn't necessarily a reflection on the CIA's spying ability. More, it is a reflection on the difficulties of establishing assets, human intelligence assets, in the Soviet Union. So,
hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story.
In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Soviet spies in the West were easier for the Soviets to run prior to 1956 and then 1968, because many of them were ideological recruits. People like Philby, for example, in MI6, who were true believers. They believed that Soviet communism was a progressive force, and that this, compared to Western capitalist imperialism, was more likely to yield goods to humanity than anything else. Obviously, there was an immense amount of self-deception going on here, and it took a great deal of effort for Soviet recruits in Western intelligence services to look at the show trials, the gulags, collectivization, famines, and the mass killings that accompanied Soviet actions in Eastern Europe, and not to see that as anything other than a simply unfortunate collateral damage. But the ideological mindset of Soviet agents in British and American intelligence meant that they were more likely to undergo the difficulties and the risks of intelligence work, whereas the Americans and the British found it much, much harder. And it's not impossible, for they did have defectors, but they found it much, much harder to have these figures within Soviet or East European intelligence. Normally, the people such as Oleg Gordievsky and other Soviet defectors became disillusioned with the Soviet Union following the crushing of the Hungarian uprising in 1956 or the Prague Spring in 1968. And those two incidents, combined with the general poor performance of the Soviet economy, declining Soviet living standards, and a lack of freedoms within the Soviet Union, created their fair share of discontented and jaded officials. If you ever read the Mitrokhin Archive by Vasily Mitrokhin and co-authored by Christopher Andrew, you get a very compelling picture of a KGB field officer come archivist who was able to smuggle out 12 suitcases of intelligence material at the end of the Cold War. And this was a disillusioned desk officer who was bitter about the Prague Spring and its aftermath. The CIA's lack of intelligence within the Soviet Union had some serious consequences. Well, it came close to having serious consequences anyway. Eisenhower thought, he mused with the idea, whether it would be advisable to launch an all-out nuclear strike on the Soviet Union before they obtained the means of destroying America. Again, this uncertainty as to Soviet intentions made tensions incredibly high, risks incredibly high. We see this again in the early 1980s, with in the reverse, with Operation Able Archer, where a war game, a NATO war game, along the borders of the Warsaw Pact, was so realistic that Andropov, as General Secretary, believed that a invasion of the Soviet Union, perhaps a nuclear strike, was imminent and was preparing a first strike response. And it was only the urging of Soviet agents to their Western counterparts that there was no joke, and there was potentially a first nuclear strike, a first strike from the Soviet Union against NATO cities on the cards, that led to the war games being rapidly scaled down and then announced that they had been concluded satisfactorily. Declassified minutes show that Eisenhower thought that, and I quote, "the hour of decision were at hand, and that we should presently have to really face the question of whether or not we should have to throw everything at once against the enemy." Eisenhower had raised this terrible question because there was no sense in our now merely shuddering at the enemy's capability. It was unclear how many thermonuclear weapons the Soviet Union had. Eisenhower continues, "We were engaged in the defence of a way of life, and the great danger was that in defending this way of life, we would find ourselves resorting to methods that endangered this way of life. The real problem, as Eisenhower saw it, was to devise methods of meeting the Soviet threat and of adopting controls, if necessary, that would not result in our transformation into a garrison state." The whole thinking, said Eisenhower, was a paradox. A garrison state, that's an interesting term. So when Eisenhower was talking about meeting the threat of the Soviet Union without destroying the American way of life, he wasn't talking about the possibility of America being reduced to a nuclear wasteland, but the fear that America would turn into an undemocratic, paranoid, hyper-militarized state, as all democratic societies risk doing if the balance of spending on arms and armies and the means of defence outweighs all aspects of society. Alan Dulles argued caution. He believed that the Russians had the capability of launching an attack on the US tomorrow, he said. Eisenhower said, I don't think anyone here thought the cost of winning a global war against the Soviet Union was a cost too high to pay. The Joint Chiefs of Staff agreed with Eisenhower, and they agreed that if American life had to change, if America had to transition from being a liberal democracy to being a warlike Spartan state, then so be it. In some of the NSC minutes, one of the Chiefs of Staff controversially said, "We could lick the whole world if we were willing to adopt the system of Adolf Hitler." This is obviously hyperbole. I don't think that there was any serious consideration of turning 50s America into a fascist dictatorship. You could argue that 50s America was highly conservative with a small c, but that and fascism ain't the same thing. And obviously Eisenhower, having been Supreme Commander, Allied Forces, Europe, and had been one of the signatories in the surrender of the Nazis, wasn't really willing to countenance such talk. Eisenhower believed that a renewed initiative on the part of the CIA would help to rebalance the situation, would help not only to gather necessary information to understand Soviet intentions, but also would help to undermine Soviet satellite states from within. This, in 1953, in June, was shown to be a false dawn. In direct response to the death of Stalin and the belief that there would now be liberalisation, the East Berliners went on strike. On June the 16th and 17th, 370,000 East Germans took to the streets, not in Berlin, just in Berlin, but across the country, and there were riots against the declining living standards imposed by the new communist-backed administration. Soviet and East German Communist Party buildings were burned to the ground, and Soviet tanks crushed the crowds. There were this was a much, much bigger uprising than anybody in the CIA had predicted. However, the CIA realised that they could do virtually nothing to help. Frank Wisner, and we spoke about him previously, considered trying to arm East Berliners. And then he realised that this really did provoke the possibility of World War III. The covert agents and covert armies that the CIA had tried to build up inside East Germany, inside Poland, Ukraine and other parts of Eastern Europe turned out to be of negligible use in these sorts of crises. The uprising was crushed. And Weisner said that the CIA at this point should do nothing at this time to incite East Germans to further actions, knowing that it would be fruitless, and just give the Soviets opportunities to crush as many civilians as possible. Quite extraordinarily then, a week after the uprising was crushed, Eisenhower gave the order to create essentially an underground army in Eastern Europe. That could launch large-scale raids or sustained warfare in East Germany and other Soviet satellites that would assassinate government ministers. And this rather fanciful and imaginative initiative finally showed Eisenhower the limitations of what the CIA could reasonably achieve in Eastern Europe. The attempts to roll back the Soviet Union in Eastern Europe using guerrilla armies that had begun under Frank Weisner began to fall apart in 1953, and any ambition that this was ever going to be possible finally dies a death that year. Eisenhower calls a meeting of his chiefs of staff, chiefs of national security, and the whole project is gradually ground down. The CIA would now, instead of fighting in or attempting to fight the enemy in the spheres of influence, the established spheres of influence of the Soviet Union that had really been agreed at the end of the Second World War, i.e. Eastern Europe, now a war on the periphery would begin. This would be a struggle against the Soviet Union and communist expansion in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and the Middle East. It would really be a struggle where dying colonial empires created opportunities for Soviet expansionism, such as, for example, Vietnam. And a lot of the subsequent events of the Cold War that really involve American subversion and American counter-Soviet actions can be explained by this moment, this 1953 Solarium meeting of Eisenhower, when the head-on attack against the Soviet Union, the head-on covert attack, was decided to be a non-starter, and the war on the periphery then began. Okay, well, I hope you find that interesting and useful, and I'm going to catch up with more of this in a subsequent podcast, as I normally do. And if you can, please drop by our Facebook page, give us a thumbs up, say hi, and a comment. Or if you can, please go to our iTunes page and give us a good review. That'd be much obliged. Anyway, speak to you soon. All the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.